Hello and welcome to the Storytelling with Puck podcast. We will, as always, start with a story.
So when I was 18 years old, I was pretty much wouldn't say boo to a goose and, you know, hadn't had a huge amount of life experience at that point. But I failed one of my A-levels and had to retake and decided to have a gap year. So as part of the gap year, I went to Africa, which at the time I can't actually work out how I got to that decision, but it seemed like the right thing to do. So we went on this amazing working tour, essentially, where we did sort of jobs for the first half of the trip. And then we went around Africa visiting a lot of wildlife and other things on the second half. And it's the second half that I want to talk about because I have always loved animals since I was a child. I've always wanted to work with animals since I was a child. But at school, I was told you can't work with animals because you don't have an A-level in biology. And going to Africa changed that quite significantly, actually. But it's my first wildlife experience I really want to talk about. So we'd started doing game drives in South Africa, and I just loved every single second of it. And then we went to Botswana. And of all the countries we visited, Botswana really stands out to me as being amazing. And it's partly because of this experience. We decided to camp overnight in Maremi Game Reserve. And we went to set up our tents. And we got there and there were some very angry tourists there because they had been staying in this spot for about a week, I think. And they didn't want to leave. And our game guide very calmly explained to them that actually, no, we've got the paperwork to prove that we've booked for tonight and that, you know, this is a legitimate booking. And they argued it and they got quite angry about it, but eventually they agreed to move on. So they packed up their stuff and we set up our tents and then we went on an evening game drive. And it was amazing. It was wonderful. But I was so excited about coming back to my first kind of overnight camping experience in the wild. And our game guide had already explained that basically the minute the lights go out, the hyenas will invade the camp. You will see them moving around, hear them moving around. And if you want to have a good look, then you basically just leave the mosquito netting of your tent closed and leave the flaps of your tent open, which as an 18-year-old, I was like, of course, that makes perfect sense. You know, that will protect me from hyenas. It got a bit weird, though, because we got back to our tent and we found a chicken bone in the doorway of our tent. And we went, there hadn't been a chicken bone there when we left. And there wasn't any sign of anybody being there. So we had a kind of a quick look around and there was actually a number of chicken bones underneath our tent as well. And we knew when we set up a tent, there was no way we'd left chicken bones. We didn't have, hadn't eaten chicken. So we kind of figured maybe the people who were very unhappy about being kicked off had come back and had kind of set us up for a bit of a prank or I don't know, whatever it was meant to be. But anyway, as far as we were aware, we cleaned up all these chicken bones and threw them away. And then we went to bed. So it was me and two others in our tent. We'd left the mosquito. I'd convinced them to leave the mosquito net enclosed and leave the flaps of the tent open so that I could check out. And as the minute the lights went out, this massive hyena came out of the darkness and jumped up onto the picnic table we'd been having food on previously and started sniffing around. And I was just absolutely captivated. I was like, this is the most incredible thing. And then the girl who was in the sleeping bag next to me gave a little squeal. And I was like, what's that? And then there was a scratching noise by the tent. And one of the hyenas was digging underneath where her head had been in the sleeping bag, luckily on the outside of the tent. Presumably looking for chicken bones. So that was a bit kind of at that point, it was like, okay, this is very cool, but a little bit scary. And then there was this really heavy, deep breathing and this head just emerged around the tent flap. And this big hyena, I have no idea if it was a male or female because the females are actually bigger than the males and they look fairly identical, even down to their pseudo penises. Basically stood and stepped into the porchway of the tent and was about a foot away. And I was in the middle of the tent. I was sat here. There's a mosquito netting here and there's a hyena's face literally a foot away from me. And I just stared into its eyes. I don't know for how long, probably literally seconds. And then it broke and ran away. At which point the two people either side of me had a bit of a breakdown because they basically had their heads buried in their sleeping bags and couldn't believe that I'd been so brave or stupid or both to stare down a hyena. And yeah, that was it. I literally spent the rest of the night. I didn't sleep a wink. I just stared out into the darkness. And by later on, you couldn't see a single thing. Like, the hyenas kind of moved off. But I was just like, I want more of this. That was the most incredible thing. And then the next morning, obviously, we took the tents down, ready to move on. And we did discover there had actually been more chicken bones underneath our tent, which is why the hyenas were so interested in us. Nobody else had had that same experience. Nobody else's tent had been set up in the way that ours was. But that moment pretty much changed the way my life was going to go, I think. That was the real first kind of time I'd experienced wildlife that close and that intensely. And it was the best thing that I'd ever experienced. So it basically mapped out the way that the rest of my trip in Africa went. And then it went mapped out how the rest of my life has gone since then. So whether it was fate or whatever it was, but I was actually pretty lucky that we pissed off some tourists and they laced our tent with chicken bones, because it had quite a profound impact, more than they ever thought they'd know, probably. So that's my story.
Wow. This is a podcast, so people won't have been able to see both my eyes and mouth opening wider and wider as you were telling that story, but we're not going to talk about it just yet, Mark. Thank you so much. I can't wait to dig into it more. The puns are coming out already. And to find out a bit more about you as well. But before we do that, let's have a quick introduction to the podcast.
You're listening to Storytelling with Puck, the podcast designed to show the power of stories in life and in business. Stories connect us on a deeper level, which is why we'll be sharing, chatting about, and feeling the impact they have on every one of us. Your host, Stefano, is the founder of Puck Creations, and we work with your business to define a clear, consistent, relevant brand which stands out from the crowd. We use that brand to create content that makes your audience think, feel, and take action. Visit puckcreations.com to find out more.
Before you do that, a little warning. Our guest for this episode has been known to get a little kinky. He has definitely been seen monkeying around, and he's also known for his bite. Mark Kingston Jones, let's build back up your reputation. Tell us something about yourself.
All those things are true. So I don't know how to follow on from that, really. So I work with animals. I'm very privileged to do that. And it's quite hard to work with animals sometimes. So I basically did it by taking advantage of corporates and their time and money to get them building stuff for the animals that I want to work with. And it's panned out quite well.
I really like that. Is that how you sell it to them as well? Do you go into a corporate and say, I'm here to take advantage of your time and money? That's a good sale.
That's how we introduce every team build. It's we're here to solve a problem and we're basically going to use you to do it.
Absolutely brilliant. Tell us a little bit more about your team builds. What are you doing? Because people possibly have very varying opinions on what team building days are, how much or little fun they can potentially be, and what's involved in them. So how are yours different? What are you doing?
So basically our aim is to improve animal welfare through our team builds. So whenever we get a group coming in, we essentially have a chat with the organizer and find out what it is they actually want to do from a team building point of view. And then we design something for the animals that meets the animals' needs, but also actually meets the organizer's criteria. But the thing I really like about our team builds, it actually works really well for us that most people hate team building. Because normally when people turn up to our team builds, they know they're doing a team build. And so they've all got this kind of face of, oh, I don't want to do this. I'm going to have to do something embarrassing. And they know they're in an animal park or, you know, a sanctuary. So they kind of, they're even almost possibly more on edge because they're like, oh God, what could it possibly be? And then they kind of see the tools and materials on the table and they look really confused. And then we tell them, you're going to build stuff for the animals. And you see their faces, for the most part, unless they really don't like animals, brighten up. And then we tell them what they're going to build for the animals, and the faces drop again. And it's this emotional roller coaster that you see within a period of about 3 minutes of like, oh, team building, oh, animals, oh God, what am I going to have to do? And it works really well to kind of then build up the anticipation of when we then split them into groups. And you then sort of slowly see the buy-in as people start kind of working and thinking at the beginning, there's no way we can possibly achieve this. I don't build stuff. I've never used a drill before. I'm not DIY proficient, you know, it can't work, to the point where you then kind of almost about halfway through, you sort of see it click when they're like, oh, actually we're getting somewhere here. And we're going to get to watch this go in with animals. And then it kind of builds to the sort of the final where they're then standing by their creation going, wow, we made that, which in itself actually would probably be enough to then go, right, thanks for coming. But then we take it and we put it in with the animals, and hopefully they get to see a response. We obviously can't guarantee it. You know, we can't promise the animal's going to come and engage with it straight away. And in fact, for some of the stuff we build, that's actually not that desirable outcome anyway, because we want it to be a bit of a slow build. But just seeing it in the enclosure, knowing their hard work's paid off, really kind of makes it different.
Give us a more concrete example. Tell us about a specific thing that you built on a particular occasion where it did work out in the way that you'd wanted it to, and that you got that excitement. And also the most important part, as you say, for you, is that the animals had something which they needed.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, I mean, we've only just obviously given the current sort of 16 months or so, we've had a bit of a break from doing corporate team builds. But we started again. We had our first booking that we were able to do and allowed to do back in July, beginning of July. So we went up to Yorkshire Wildlife Park, and it was actually a booking that had been postponed 6 times.
Wow.
Over an 18-month period, actually. And it was actually for some people from the NHS, which actually made it quite nice. Like they'd waited through the entirety of lockdown and everything they'd been through to finally have this team build. And it's something the keepers had requested like 2 years before. So it obviously took us a bit of time to get the keepers what they wanted as well. But we were building for an okapi, which possibly a lot of people won't have heard of.
Well, even if everybody else in the world has heard of it, I'm ignorant, so you can tell me.
So its closest living relative is a giraffe.
Okay.
So imagine a giraffe head, but in brown, same long tongue, same kind of, you know, protruding horns on the head. With a kind of a brown neck and body to about halfway, and then the bottom half of a zebra.
What? have you been watching sci-fi again?
Yeah, well, no, it's, yeah, no, they're
that's amazing.
They're the most. They're basically like a mini forest kind of giraffe, I guess. But they, they're actually a very shy animal. They kind of live solitary lives in the, you know, deepest Congo kind of thing. And they're endangered species. But yeah, they have this amazing, like their kind of giraffe cousins, they have this amazing long tongue and sort of, you know, not as long as a giraffe, but a long neck that they use to kind of browse from trees, eating kind of the leaves and shoots and things. So the keepers really wanted something that was going to get the giraffes using those adaptations, essentially. So we designed this feeder that pops on top of the fence, essentially, on a bungee pivot. So essentially you've got an arm that sits and rocks. It's a podcast, so you can't see my arm doing that. but you've got an arm that basically sits across either side of the fence on a bungee. And as one okapi pulls kind of on one side, the other side kind of bounces around. So it mimics eating live branches, basically, by resisting them, pulling back and bouncing out the way. So they have to work a bit harder to get their leaves, which is what they'd be doing in the wild. So yeah, we had this group. Sorry, go on.
No, so I was just going to ask, so for lots of listeners, they might not understand what the point of that would be. So why are you mimicking the wild? What's the benefit to the animals of mimicking the wild?
So that's said to be a very good question, which no one's really asked me before.
I occasionally come up with them. Sorry, go on.
No. But no, it is. It's. I mean, obviously, we're very aware that we're working with animals in a captive setting. It is an artificial setting, but for a lot of animals, that doesn't mean we can't kind of maintain natural behaviours. And there's a lot that we can do through what we call enrichment, which is basically kind of, you know, things like feeders or enclosure furniture that basically works and kind of mentally and physically as they would do if they were kind of working for food or climbing around in the wild. And it obviously, in showing those natural behaviors, it keeps them physically fit and healthy.
Okay.
I'm actually not 100% sure if it works the same for a carpy, but certainly for giraffe. In the wild, they spent hours and hours and hours using that massive 18-inch long tongue to get leaves off trees. If in captivity you feed them a really quick and easy diet, then that tongue isn't being put to use, and they actually develop quite a nasty behavior where they basically, everyone knows kind of like, you know, big cats pacing and stuff, and they go, it's because they're bored or whatever. That's not necessarily true, but it's the equivalent of that in a giraffe, is basically using their tongue and kind of flicking it around and kind of mouthing inanimate objects, because they are designed to use that adaptation a lot. And if they don't, they have to let it out in another way. So obviously the best thing that we can do is actually provide them challenges that get them using that tongue in a natural way. So it's good for them. It's good for, you know, having to think about it. They're having to exercise and stretch and work. And it's, you know, it's not just working the tongue. It's working the entire body. It's working the brain. And it's keeping them fit and healthy. And it's giving them the best life that we can possibly give them in an artificial situation.
That's a very well-rounded answer. And it completely explains what I was trying to get at. It also gives me something which every time I talk to you, for our listeners, Mark and I have known each other for quite a while. Every time I talk to you and you mention an animal's behavior, I am almost instantly thinking about analogies with humans, because in a similar way, part of the problem of a modern human is that we don't exercise a lot of the muscles that we used to exercise because we have no need to anymore. We live often fairly sedentary lives where we're working in offices, go home, sit on the sofa, watch TV. And so we're putting on weight, obviously, which isn't a great thing from a health point of view. But we're also not potentially using our calf muscles properly, or we're not using a lot of our upper body strength just completely disappears because we don't need it at all. Mm-hmm. And that can cause us to be really, really unhealthy. So I'm guessing for animals that are usually, as you say, over millennia, have been evolving to use these muscles, if they're not using them, it's going to cause short-term behavioral problems, but also much, much longer-term problems, I'm guessing, yeah, if they were kept in captivity for a long time. And
yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, most animals, with a few exceptions, will live a longer life in captivity anyway. Mm. So like the most obvious, kind of going back to your analogy of like the sedentary lifestyle in a kind of an office and working on a computer, big cats basically in the wild would live around about 10, maybe 15 years at an outside kind of chance. In captivity, they can potentially live to about 25. But if they're not, we actually have data that shows if they're not using their muscles and their bones the way that they would be exercising regularly, if they're living this sedentary kind of couch potato lifestyle, by the age of about 6 to 8 years old, they start to develop arthritis. Wow. So then you've got potentially another maybe 20 years of an animal living with chronic arthritis. Whereas we know there are certain particularly kind of well-known essentially, I guess, gym equipment for big cats, you know, it's basically like a pole feed. So you put a piece of meat at the top of a very tall pole. And although big cats aren't chasing up trees in the wild to bring down their prey, the muscles that they use to race up that pole, grab the meat and come back down is the same muscles and bone structures they'd be using in the wild to bring down animals. If we use that, there's been animals that have kind of passed away, you know, maybe an unnatural cause kind of earlier in life, but their bone structures are pristine. There's no sign of any degeneration at all. And obviously, you know, that is an analogy we can apply to humans. We can keep ourselves fit and healthy. We can make, everyone thinks of muscles when they talk about working out at the gym and stuff, but your muscles are attached to your bone structures. So as you're working the muscles, it's pulling on the bone structures. It's kind of, you know, it's making those structures stronger and more resilient, basically. Whereas the more kind of sedentary life we lead, those bone structures are, you know, and anyone who works at an office, you kind of then you're bent over a computer and then you go and try and sit up straight and you can't anymore because your back has worked out. This is the position that you stay in. So this is the way your bones have reformed. Whereas if you force yourself to kind of regularly sit upright, and you can get your posture back as your bones kind of regrow and rebuild continually. So we can apply all of that stuff across to the animals, and it works for pets as well. You know, we're talking about the same, if you've got, you know, dogs and cats at home and stuff that are are living a sedentary lifestyle, they're going to have similar issues that you're going to have to deal with into later life. So you can apply it across the whole animal kingdom, even if people don't want to include people in the animal kingdom.
Well, we definitely are part of the animal kingdom.
But you'd be surprised how many people argue with that.
No, I'm not surprised, sadly. I've actually had these arguments, and I don't work in your profession. But but I wonder how many people listening did exactly what I did just then and sat up straight as she started talking about that, because I know that the Hunchback of Notre Dame has nothing on me. But you make so many valid points about how we need to look after animals if they're in the care of the keepers, as you talk about, if they're in humans' care as pets as well. There are, I'm fairly certain you probably don't want to go into this, so I won't go too deep, but there are always obviously discussions around captivity and whether or not captivity is a good thing in general, whether or not there's nuance behind it, etc., etc., and even whether or not keeping pets is a good idea. There are always going to be these discussions, but we won't go into them for today, but let's at least acknowledge that if they are going to be kept into captivity, the very least we can do is make sure that they have the best lives they can possibly have and look after them in that way. So the looking after the animal side and the building for the animals is vitally important. But obviously corporate companies aren't going to, and even the NHS, aren't going to go into a team build purely for that reason. They also want to be able to build their team, yeah, as it says on the tin. So let's go back to the example with the NHS. How did it help them? What did they get out of it by the end?
Well, it's the thing I really like, again, about, I mean, I'm biased, obviously, because we designed these workshops, but the thing I really liked about them, and this one's a really good example, because when, again, at the beginning of the event, when we're explaining to people that we kind of use their time and money to fix a problem in the animal world, we want to make sure they get something out of it. And we obviously tell them that we want them to have a team bonding experience. But we say, you know, how many of you have actually used tools before? And, you know, normally about sort of half the room kind of tentatively put their hands up, but, you know, and then you go all safely and then half of that group put their hands back down again. And those are the people you immediately want to keep an eye on. But in this case, most of the people were like, no, we've never used a drill before. We've never used a saw before. So it was a completely new learning experience for them. And there's a really nice individual empowerment to that. We're not one of those team builders that kind of, you know, forces everybody to do everything and pushing them into a situation they're really not comfortable with, because actually there's health and safety issues with doing that. But it sounds really stupid, but we use coach screws, which are different to like normal, a lot of the time anyway, we use coach screws, which are normal to normal screws. But there's something really satisfying about driving a coach screw into a chunk of timber and watching it clamp another piece of timber to it so solidly. And it sounds ridiculous, but you give a, you know, someone who's never used a drill before a drill, and you say, right, put this in here, and they're kind of like having a go, and you just see the confidence grow, and you see that it's like a little Yahoo moment when it drives it in, and you're like, whoa, I did that, and that's really solid. That's not going to come apart. And it's a really cool moment. So within the team build itself, I think that's one of the major things that people get out of working with us. It's that little, those little moments of triumph through there that kind of make it fun on an individual basis. But then hopefully, if we're doing it right, everybody else in the room is also having their own little Yahoo moments. And so as a team as well, everybody's getting these little euphoric kind of hits together, bonding as a group, laughing as a group, joking as a group, achieving as a group. Because again, the way we design the stuff that we do, it can't be done by one person. Even if you've got, you know, a DIY hero in the room, mm-hmm. and we have had it occasionally where they've basically tried to take control, it's very, very quickly obvious that that's not going to work in the time that they've got, and that the group almost kind of then rebels a little bit and goes, actually, step off. You know what you're doing, but you need our help. And then it kind of floods back out again. And there's some really nice moments from that as well. So
I can imagine that's a perfect dynamic, actually, for a lot of workers in the corporate world. You'll see People quite often, actually, it's not the top boss. It's somebody who's just a little bit lower down who wants to take control, and they're potentially looking for a promotion and also want to show that they're, you know, better than all of their underlings. He does that kind of jumping in. And I imagine you get it within the public sector too. Obviously, I'm stereotyping quite a lot here, but when you have situations where you are forced to work together, the only way you're going to get something done is by working as a team. I imagine that can, for future scenarios when they go back into the office or back onto the wards, can help to change a mindset, which is, I guess, the most important thing. It's not about what's happening on that day.
Yeah.
It's about what happens afterwards. And if you build that confidence, then you have more confidence afterwards. If you have built a team dynamic where you realize that the only way to get things done, or you at least get things done better, is to work as a team, then you're able to push forward in that way as well. Am I getting that right? Or
yeah, no, absolutely. And it is. It's also kind of, so the other thing that we tend to find when we talk to people about kind of team building and stuff is that most team builds all kind of roll into one. Like, you don't have a strong memory of this time we did team building together.
Yeah.
Whereas ours, because it's very specifically focused, and it's because it's for a good, meaningful outcome, it becomes memorable. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's a really powerful thing as well, because again, when we've talked to teams afterwards, the fact is the memories of that team bonding event keep popping up again. So like you say, exactly that. You're in a situation where there's kind of, you've hit a flashpoint at work, and you've kind of, you're struggling to deal with someone, or you're trying to do it on your own, and you kind of, you get this memory back of when you actually were working together sort of succinctly and well, and that what you achieved from that teamwork, then actually you kind of come draw that back in. And from at least one of the conversations we've had, I just happened to get about 18 months later some video from one of the keepers of something that we'd built. And I still had the email address for the client. So I just sort of sent it to them and said, oh, you know, just so you know, 18 months later, this is your stuff still being used. And the guy who was in charge of the company wrote back and went, actually, it's funny, we still talk about that day. Even last week, we were still talking about that day 18 months ago.
Amazing.
And it's like, you know, and that was without the prompting, but it's just like, you know, if you've got that kind of that team sense that's being continually reinforced through those memories, through looking back, you should also be remembering all of that bonding experience, all of those relationships that you created during that, and kind of think, yeah, I can keep using those. I can keep working on those. I think it's a really powerful thing that it's bringing people together, but also because it's memorable, it keeps keeping people together rather than just like, oh, I've forgotten about, you know, that day a year ago when we built that raft that then got taken apart again at the end of it.
That makes a lot of sense. It's good advertising for you, Deb, but I think it's also genuine because you do see a huge difference in what you're doing. And there's another side to what you've been doing recently, which I've been able to see a lot more closely. And this is because over the pandemic, it's a horrible, horrible situation for everyone. For yourselves, as you mentioned earlier briefly, it meant that you weren't able to do these team builds. And that's a huge challenge, not only for you, but obviously for all the teams you want to be able to get together, and for the animals too. But you did something which I thought was quite spectacular, and I then was able to get involved in a little bit myself, very little bit, just in terms of helping to support it. But tell our listeners a little bit about what you did and how that is still then able to help the animals.
Yeah, so we basically, as you say, we were really frustrated because we, you know, we're not built for working in offices. We're not built for sort of sitting and just doing nothing. So
you need to work your tongue muscles, right?
Yeah, no, literally, like if this lockdown has taught me anything, it's that I actually desperately, for my own mental health, I need to work with animals regularly, or I actually suffer. And it is for me, it's a massive relief. And so we were looking for any way we possibly could to kind of, to do that again. So the minute that the kind of the first lockdown eased, and they said people could go back to work, we were like, well, we're people, we can't work in our offices. We need to find a way of getting back out. But yes, our whole business model is actually set up on corporate groups basically funding us to build stuff for animals. So then, you know, that doesn't work when they're not able or prepared to do that. So it was actually Jackie Jagger basically suggested that we set up a subscription where people could actually help us help the animals for basically, you know, to get us back out there, but also because those individuals that are helping to support get a really nice feel-good factor from actually seeing where that support is going. So we started up a Patreon channel. We'd never actually heard of Patreon up until about the middle of June last year. And then Jackie made this suggestion and we put it out to our team and said, if anyone's got any ideas. And luckily one of them went, oh, Patreon, that literally exists to fill that niche, basically. So we signed up, we got started, and we started building things. So once a month, we'll pick a project, either for a behavioral goal that, you know, is sorely needed. Or in some cases, like this month, we've just been working at a monkey sanctuary, which does an amazing job with extremely limited resources. And they had one of their enclosures, which is actually a really good sized enclosure for two rescued capuchin monkeys, that all the furniture inside was basically kind of falling down because it was, you know, it was old and it needed replacing. So this month, our patrons basically funded us to go and spend a day there. A few of our team members also come and volunteered as well. So there was about five of us, and we literally kind of ripped everything out that was falling down and rebuilt it in a day. And it was amazing, like, to see that transformation. And, you know, and again, like, you know, we used donated materials, we bought some materials with some of the funding that we've been given and stuff. So it was a really nice kind of combination. And yeah, it's that moment at the end of the day when you kind of let the monkeys back out. And in fairness, this month the monkeys are pretty shell-shocked because, you know, they left their home the night before, got locked inside, obviously, because we can't work in there with them, and kind of came out the next day and was like, oh, what the hell happened to my house? So it took them a little while to kind of warm up to it. But we've been talking to the kind of the owner of the sanctuary since, and he's like, they're all over it. They're using it every day. They love heights. Like, one, Gizzy, the little female, she's a tiny little capuchin monkey that's basically lived as a pet in Scotland for 22 years. So she's too small because she's not been fed right. She's skinny as a rake, and she was just flying over it. And it's just, it's amazing to see, but it's actually, it's weird. I always usually get my kick from seeing the animal's response, and then a kind of a secondary kick from seeing the human's response to the animal's response. But actually with the Patreon, it feels like a lot of pressure, because like, people are giving us their hard-earned money, and it's like, that's a lot of responsibility. Like, when you're doing a team build, you're delivering a service, and it's, you know, very clear you've delivered that service and you've done a good job, kind of thing. But when someone's donating to you once a month to kind of do good things for animals, that feels, that's quite a heavy weight. I like it. I like that there are people out there who are willing to do that and think what we do is cool, but it actually feels like a lot of responsibility. So sometimes it's a bit stressful, but it's in a weird way, I like it a lot.
I understand that. I understand that suddenly, as you say, it's all your work. It's not other people's work, and that you're kind of aiding them with. I will say, from a personal point of view, again, I'm on a very small tier of it, but I do enjoy the emails that you send out, and I do enjoy getting to see the work that you've done because of it. So this is for the animals way more than it is for the humans, as you say. But at the same time, there's at least one human who gets a lot of benefit from it as well. So don't feel the pressure. There's no pressure on you from me. But I will say that take the pleasure off the fact that it's definitely something great to see. And I'm fairly certain you'll hear the same thing from all of the other Patreon subscribers as well. So it's an absolutely amazing thing. And what's clear from what you just described then, from Patreon itself, from the team builds previously, is how much you really, really do care about the animals and how much you really do want to do your best for them. Now, we started this episode with one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard. Before we get into your time in Botswana and the actual story, at the very beginning of it, you mentioned that you had wanted to work with animals since you were a kid. How did that start?
Always an interesting and often a tough question. Why did you want to do what you do? Have you ever really thought about that for your own industry? While you ponder, let's take a moment to reflect on Mark's not so funny hyena experience, to remember what an okapi is, and to think about what's coming next. Once Mark tells us more about why he does what he does, we'll get into the serious questions around having animals in captivity. We'll hear some more wonderful animal stories, and we'll have a bit of a kinky ending from Puck Creations. Okay, Mark's ready. We're ready. We hope you're ready. Let's go.
I don't even really know. I know some people who, like, you know, or colleagues of mine now who, like, you know, can very clearly say, oh, we watched this David Attenborough program and it just completely inspired me, or I did this zoo trip and I saw this animal doing a cool thing, and I always just, from then on, I don't really have a set. I don't think there was a set moment. I think I've always just been fascinated with animals. And my grandmother actually told me, it was after I started my first sort of zoo job, after university, she kind of, when I went to visit, she pulled out this photo that she'd kind of dug out of the attic. And apparently, so her uncles, I think, she had two, basically kind of the opposite end of the scale of what I'm trying to do now, used to procure animals and sell them in places like Harrods. So so there was a picture of one of my uncles basically lying with his arm around this massive full-grown male lion. And another picture of walking two bear cubs on chains in London.
As you said, that's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum of what you're trying to do now, right?
Yeah. I like to think I'm fixing the problem that was caused, like, but, you know. But it, like, you know, she was like, you know, you were kind of following in their footsteps. And I mean, and to be honest, that is how this all started. I mean, David Attenborough, you know, started his career going out to far-flung places and collecting animals live on, not live on TV, obviously, but for TV programs, and then bringing them back and giving them to London Zoo. Like, there's no kind of glorifying that, you know, that's actually where, that's where the original animals came from. You know, there wasn't the expertise to breed them back then. There wasn't the, you know, it took years and years for anyone to work out the right conditions needed for gorillas to actually reproduce and rear their young successfully, you know, in a captive setting, because they're incredibly sensitive animals and they need the right conditions to be able to. It's not just chuck a pair in a cage and, you know, they're not getting off the ark and being like, right, let's make babies, it's all good kind of thing. So I shouldn't clap and probably went straight in their ears. That's going to wake everybody up. You know, there is a lot of knowledge that's been gained over the years, granted by doing things that nowadays we wouldn't do. But I mean, there's a lot of things out there now that are very similar kind of starting points. So you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, well, as you say, as well, I guess the ideology was probably completely wrong back then. And even as you say with David Attenborough, it probably wasn't exactly the right ideology when he first started. But it was the interest that you can compare what you're doing now to. So there was an interest in animals, and maybe then what was happening with them afterwards wasn't good for the animals, and the intention was more selfish, I imagine, to a degree. But with what you're doing now, it's, to me anyway, seems to be much, much more about the looking after the animals, but you still get the selfish indulgence because people don't do stuff like this if it's not for themselves too. So you're still getting the indulgence of having the pleasure of being with animals and spending time with them, which I think is an indulgence that, well, most people could completely understand. But it's not your primary goal. Your primary goal is now to look after the animals. And to me, that seems to be the difference. I'm projecting, I'm not here, but am I going on the right path? Or?
No, you are. I mean, as I say, I don't think I actually realised quite how selfish it was until lockdown prohibited me from working with animals. You know, when I started, you know, that story and what led on from after that story, like, it literally changed my mindset and what I knew would make me happy. And so there is absolutely anyone who works with animals, you know, they do it for the love, but, you know, that love is reinforcing. You know, it's amazing when if you've got pets at home and you've got a really close bond with them, then, you know, there's a massive personal benefit to working with animals. But no, I mean, as you say, my aim is whether you agree with animals in captivity or not. And I do fall on the side that I promote good zoos that are doing good work and can justify that goodness, essentially. I disagree with the existence of bad zoos that aren't doing good welfare. I don't think they should exist. And I think and within the industry, we should be doing a lot to stop them existing.
That's fair. If you don't mind, because you are talking, I wasn't sure if you wanted to talk about this, which is why I didn't ask the question earlier. But as you started, I can't now just let it slide. So, so this always, to be honest, makes me confused more than anything else, because I'm not in your world, and because I'm not in the world of zoos, and I'm not in the world of supposed sanctuaries. I say supposed because some of them are and some of them seem not to be, especially you've explained this to me a little bit in the past too. That if I ever go to a zoo, internally I'm conflicted because I don't know about the zoo. I'm wondering whether or not I see some animals and I see descriptions of the animals, and it explains that if these particular animals weren't taken out of the wild, that they would have died out. And so actually the whole reason for them being in captivity is to keep them alive. And I'm like, okay, that's a good reason. I then see some other animals and I think, I can't see any reason for you being in this zoo. I have no idea why you're here, which means it's purely for my pleasure. And because I'm human, I'm kind of like, and it is really quite pleasurable to see, because it's, you know, it's like, this is amazing. And then I have this other side of me, which goes, but I'm not sure if I should be. And then I'm just really, really confused.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned that there are, I guess with everything in life, there are some zoos who are doing the right things. There are some zoos who are zoos that are doing the wrong things. And then there are all of these other sanctuaries and all of these other areas. How do you get a grasp of who's doing what well and who's doing what badly? And
I mean, it's for me, I always, again, there's different ways of doing it. And I mean, one of the ways for me personally, like I hear stories about lots of places, you know, in the job that I do, I hear lots of different stories, some good, some bad, but I always prefer to reserve judgment until I actually see it for myself. So whenever I go and visit somewhere, I'm not just looking at the animal in question, although obviously you can gain a lot from looking at the animal. But again, it's hard. Like one of the complaints that my previous zoo, Port Lim, used to get complaints for was, oh, the tigers are too skinny. They're emaciated. They're underweight. They were perfect looking tigers. That's how a tiger should look. The issue is most of the people looking at them have been used to looking at obese tigers elsewhere. So again, it's that little bit of knowledge is actually sometimes really dangerous. And it's that, you know, it's that keyboard warrior thing. It's like, oh, I know about tigers because I've seen them on David Attenborough and they shouldn't be doing that. And it's like, well, actually, you know, it's got to be, and welfare for humans or animals, you know, humans and animals in general, is based on an individual basis. You know, what's good welfare for you could be terrible welfare for me. You know, we could be sitting in the same room. You could be comfortable, you could be relaxed, you could be well fed, you know, you could be warm enough, and I could be sitting in exactly the same room experiencing exactly the same conditions, and I could be uncomfortable, I could be too cold, I might not have eaten because, so you've just had this delicious meal that you think is wonderful and I think is disgusting, so I haven't touched it.
My cooking isn't that bad, but yeah, keep going.
I was gonna say, kind of, you can use it if you've just had like a really nice breakfast and I'm vegetarian, so I can't eat. So it's, you know what I mean? But it's we've both been presented with exactly the same environmental conditions, but our experience of that is completely the opposite. Even though we're the same species, similar age, you know, kind of, do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
So for every animal in a captive setting, we actually, it's the reason animal welfare is so hard is because that applies to every animal in human care, whether they're in a sanctuary, whether they're in a zoo, whether they're a pet, whether they're in a lab. Like, you know, every single one of those animals is going to be experiencing the world that they live in differently. There's no one rule fits all. But it's hard when you're going somewhere and you're looking from an outside perspective and you're going, oh, that tiger does look a bit skinny, but actually I'm being told that's what they should look like. And actually that means that they are fitter and healthier than those other tigers that look a bit cuddly and, you know, I saw in this other place kind of thing. Or I've seen this massive, big open field that's a massive, big space. So it must be a wonderful space for that animal to live in. But there's actually nothing in that space, including there's no rain shelter. There's no shelter from the sun. There's nowhere to get out of the wind. There's nowhere to get away from the public. Whereas this smaller space over here that has all of those things, but it's a smaller space. So surely it must be a worse space. Do you know what I mean? There's so
yes.
many.
It leads actually to two more questions, because you've answered that really well. Thank you, by the way, because I think I'm not going to be the only one who struggles with this.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are lots of people who do, people who have, I don't have the same degree of care, I think, for animals as you do, and anywhere near the same degree. But I do still have feelings about it, and sometimes I feel really off about certain things, but I don't know why, because yeah. I don't understand it. So you helped me to understand it a little bit more. But like I say, it does lead to two more questions, because the first question is, if it's about the individual animals, and as you say, looking after them and making sure that what's right for one animal might be wrong for a different animal, so therefore you have to sort out their care separately. As an outsider who has nowhere near your knowledge, has nowhere near the knowledge of some of the people who are doing good things for animal welfare, how do we know which places to visit and which places not to visit? Because I have no idea what's good and what isn't.
Yeah, it's a really hard question. And I mean, and again, from that individual point of view, I'm sure if I were to tell you where my favorite place to go and see animals in the UK was, you could go there and have a terrible experience, because what I'm going to see is completely different to what you're going to see. Do you know what I mean? So it's,
I do.
I which means
from a welfare perspective, though, rather than from yeah. from an entertainment perspective, is more the point I'm making.
So again, I would look out for, if I'm going into a zoo, I'm not looking at, okay, this is a big enclosure, it's a good enclosure. I'm saying, okay, well, this is a medium sized enclosure, let's say. But these are all the components that, even if you don't know animals, does it have shade? Does it have somewhere to get away from rain, wind, snow? You know, do they have access back into the house whenever they want, so actually they don't have to be locked out on show? Do they, you know, do they look, you know, coat condition and things like that? I mean, again, there are exceptions, like Gizzy at the sanctuary. You know, she has terrible alopecia from her time as being kept as a pet, so she looks, her physical condition looks awful, even though she's actually really physically fit and healthy, and she's engaged in stuff. So it's
okay.
This is the trouble, there's no simple answer to it, but I think as a visitor you can ask yourself simple questions about what you're looking at. Like, some people go and they say, oh, you know, I looked at that animal in the zoo and it looked bored. Well, it's a lion, they sleep 21 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's what they do. They're not lazy. They're incredibly energy efficient. When they're up, poor, they're up. Or they should be. They should have opportunities to be up and doing and physically exercising, but they should also have the chance to actually just pass out somewhere comfortable for, you know, 21 hours a day sort of thing. So it's, I don't have a good answer. And it's not, to me, that's disappointing. But I think, again, and the other thing is, I think if you have doubts, actually find somebody who works there and ask them.
Okay.
You know, the worst thing I find is you go in and you see something, because what you're taking is a snapshot. You're taking a tiny moment out of that animal's entire 24-hour, you know, activity budget, let alone their entire life. And you're going, that's good or that's bad. But actually, if you're curious, if you're worried, then sort of find someone who works and say, look, can I actually ask, you know, when I used to work at a safari park, there was a female brown bear who would pace repeatedly through the day, and we get loads of public complaining, but I liked it when they complained to me, because I could actually say, well, I understand why this looks upsetting, and it's actually something that we're dealing with, and these are all the things that the keepers are doing to alleviate that behavioral problem.
Makes a lot of sense.
So like, if you ask them a question and they can give you a convincing answer, like, you know, actually this is all the stuff that we do behind the scenes that you'll never ever see to take care of this animal, then that should give you a sense of, but I think you can almost also read when it's kind of BS.
Yeah.
If someone had said to me, oh, why is that brown bear pacing? She looks, you know, bored or stressed or unhappy. And I'd gone, ah, no, she's fine.
Just almost dismissed it instantly. It's not.
It's not really a problem, actually. It's perfectly natural for brown bears to do that. Or, yeah, she's always done that ever since she's been here, so there's nothing we can do about it. that to me isn't a good enough answer. I appreciate that you skirted the question initially, kind of in case I didn't want to talk about it. But for me, we have to be able to talk about it. The day I can't justify what I do, I need to stop what I'm doing. If I can't justify working in a certain setting, if I can't justify, you know, a job that I've done based on trying to improve animal welfare, then actually I should probably step away and let someone else have a go.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think you're right. As much as it's a harsh thing to say, I think it's good that you're able to have this conversation. It's good that you're able to justify it as well, because it can confuse so many of us, and we're not in that world. But I think the way you describe it is perfect, because to me, what I take from that is go to places if you think they seem okay. If something feels off, don't judge, because if you're anything like me, some people will know more than me, but if you're anything like me, you don't really know what you're talking about. So don't judge. Instead of judging, ask questions, be curious. Yeah. And work that way, instead of saying a snapshot, well, I see this and it looks slightly different to X, Y, and Z, so I'm therefore going to now pronounce this place as doomed. Yeah. Instead, actually ask people who work there, maybe look it up online, but be a bit careful about who you're reading, etc., online, because I'm sure there will be people on both sides of a fence who are making a case which is possibly unworthy and unjustified.
Yeah.
So that's how I'm going to approach it now after that. So I really appreciate it. And I don't know, our listeners will have their own ideas off the back of it, but I personally appreciate it. I think now I can see it in a slightly different way. The second question I had, though, and maybe this has been answered in a sense in your previous answers, but you talked about the individual conditions for animals, and you talked about how to judge whether they're not they're being treated well within the sanctuary. A question that I still ask and I still think about sometimes is, with certain animals, why are they in a sanctuary in the first place? They're not endangered. They shouldn't live in the particular country that they're in at all, mm-hmm. because they do not suit the environment at all.
Yeah.
So, but that's how I see it. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all of the animals that are in these particular sanctuaries should be there. But are there creatures that shouldn't be where they are? And if so, how do I know? And are there other reasons for creatures being in sanctuaries that I'm not thinking about?
Yeah. So I think, well, again, the trouble with this question is there's lots of different answers to it.
Okay.
So within the kind of the zoo world and the sanctuary world and even the lab world, because, you know, many people would like to kind of distance themselves from labs and stuff, but ultimately we're all looking after animals in captivity. I personally haven't done any lab work, but I've got friends and colleagues who do, whether or not because they agree with it or because they know those animals are in captivity anyway. Nothing that they do is going to change that. So again, they would rather make sure that those animals have the best care that they can if they've got expertise to help them, which actually I think is a very noble sentiment, and it's mm-hmm. I would struggle with that personally, I think, actually, depending on what they were being used for. But as to why they're there, so some animals are rescues, so some animals are animals that have, you know, a lot of people kind of go, oh, you know, zoos have the breeding programs and they, you know, they took animals from the wild and now they're breeding them and everything. Actually, a lot of zoos will do animal rescues. They will take animals from substandard conditions and they will offer them a home. Whether or not they could then become part of the breeding program is potentially something, you know, if their genetics actually could benefit the overall population, then actually that's an added benefit. But ultimately they've been rescued from bad conditions, hopefully to much better ones. In terms of some of the animals that are in captivity, I'm guessing, are you thinking things like kind of meerkats, for example, maybe? Everyone's got meerkats and they're not an endangered species. And then
that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a mixed answer. The honest, blunt answer, I would imagine, is in most cases, and not in all, but in most cases, is everybody loves meerkats. They are incredibly entertaining and engaging animals. And they work well in captivity. You know, you can make them comfortable, you can make them happy, and you can have a good, you know, a nice group that's well looked after without, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds of worth of resources. So they're an easy species to keep, I suppose. There is a more in-depth answer to that, though, because actually, ultimately, the way our planet is going right now, even animals that weren't in any threat before actually now are. Okay. You know, like ring-tailed lemurs, for example, there was always loads of ring-tailed lemurs in zoos that were being bred, and there wasn't any kind of control or anything. I mean, the situation in Madagascar right now, these guys are in real trouble, even though they were kind of doing reasonably well and kind of being fairly prolific across Madagascar. With the kind of the political situation, the environmental situation, you know, these are animals that are now suddenly like, oh, this is a priority species potentially to look after, because if we don't have a captive safety net, we might lose the species forever. So there's kind of, it's a mix, but I think it comes down to the individual places where have they just got meerkats? They've just kind of chucked into an area that they're just, you know, keeping them there, and they're just breeding and breeding because baby meerkats, everybody loves baby meerkats and wants to pay to come and see baby meerkats. Or are they actually doing it in a responsible way? They're managing the group. They're in somewhere that's been built specifically for them, designed specifically for their needs. They're being well looked after. If they're breeding, it's being done carefully. It's being managed so that it's sustainable. You know, because these guys will breed and breed, and then they'll kick out other individuals in the group. So then you'll have individuals being left on their own. And it's so.
Yeah, I see why this is. It's really complicated. I get it. There's no easy answer.
There isn't.
And I guess as well, even if you were thinking slightly further in terms of what certain animals can do, such as meerkats, I guess if they're attracting a lot of people to a place, and then people are paying to get into a place, then people are actually paying for the welfare of some of the other animals by paying. Even if they're actually only going there to see the meerkats, they might be paying for some of the less attractive creatures to be looked after. So I can see the arguments. I still have trouble with some of it, because it's hard to get the balance right. And as you say, it's hard from an individual perspective to know which ones are right places to go to. But I think you've explained it as best as you possibly can. People will make their own judgments. Personally, I really like the stance you take. I think it makes a lot of sense. I probably take a similar, much less educated stance. I don't understand it as well as you do, but I think I take a similar stance. So I just appreciate you explaining it. But we'll come away from it for a second, and we'll get back to the more fun talk of you and your love of animals, and of you deciding to stare down a hyena in a tent. Now, I imagine most people, especially most people of my age, probably when they think of a hyena, think of what they did to Simba, and it's not very nice. And so they don't think of hyenas as necessarily, you know, the best creatures. And to be honest, I mean, obviously, I'm clearly joking. I know that hyenas are beautiful, beautiful creatures. But at the same time, in the wild, in a tent, I probably wouldn't hope that they would come right up to the tent. I would like them to be near, because that's cool, but I wouldn't want them to come right up to the tent. I wouldn't want them to be eating chicken bones underneath my head, and I probably wouldn't stare one down. Just explain.
It's kind of a tricky one. Actually, that's one of the reasons I deliberately picked that story, because, you know, Disney hasn't been kind to hyenas. They are misunderstood. And again, that was kind of part of the amazing thing for me and that experience. Like, you know, I'm glossing over what a memory was by adding my own kind of perspective from, you know, however many years later. But
yeah,
like, you know, I went out to Africa wanting to see lions and leopards and rhino and elephant, because they were the big cool species that, you know, everybody talks about, you know, seeing in Africa. You know, who wants to go and see a hyena kind of thing? But, you know, actually, that was kind of the point. It was like, this is a species I'd never even considered as being something important or that I wanted to see. And I was having this moment with it, which I'm sure stayed with me far longer than it stayed with the animal itself. Like, you know, I'm taking all this away from this amazing interaction. And it's just like, oh, can I eat it? Can I not? No, I'm going away now. Yeah. But do you know what I mean?
It probably thinks more about the chicken bones.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, you're actually on top of something that I want to eat, get out of my way. But it's this very cool animal that I'd never considered before. And it was just like, that was an amazing thing. But the other reason, like, and again, you know, I would never deliberately set up that situation. I mean, in hindsight, it was incredibly dangerous. Like, even when we were traveling around Botswana, whenever you're going around the campsites and stuff, there's stories about, oh, you know, there was a child that was dragged out of a tent by a hyena. There was a woman's tent that was pulled into the river by a crocodile. Like, you know, that I'm sure half of these stories are just like, you know, they're the kind of the urban or whatever the alternate to urban legend is.
rural myth.
Yeah, there you go. Just to kind of scare stupid tourists that want to do something like that, you know, to go, actually, these animals are dangerous. They're not under control. You've got a real problem if this goes wrong, sort of thing. So, but it was a highly artificial experience because the hyena wasn't coming to connect with me. It was coming to connect with potential food source. But to me, it was like life-changing. And I think actually that's a lot of people that go or talk about wanting to go and see animals in the wild. They don't really want to go and see animals in the wild. They want a sanitized wild where I'm guaranteed to see the big five and tick them off my list. And, you know, and it's like we on a completely different trip, we did 5 days driving around Kruger, and we had some of the most incredible wildlife spottings, like, again, that, you know, just are amazing. But in between each and every one of those wildlife spottings, there was probably 4 or 5 hours of driving and seeing nothing. And it's like, that's not what people want. They want, I want bang, bang, bang. I want, you know, I want the David Attenborough experience where I just walk into the jungle and a jaguar parades past me and hunts down
the David Attenborough experience, which he never has actually had.
I mean, that's the point. David Attenborough has actually, he's one of the reasons I love David Attenborough, because he has actually done it. He's done it the real way, and now he's found a way of bringing it to people.
So but what I mean is, I should explain when I say he's never had that. I mean he's had the experience of the animals. I'm not trying to David Attenborough. I love him.
Yeah. I was going to say, he's a golden god. You can't say bad things about David Attenborough.
I might have to make that the headline. I love David Attenborough. what I mean is that when he goes out, and he went out and saw those animals, and he did all of the stuff he did originally, he also had to have the experiences of not seeing things for a very long time before he saw them, is my point.
Absolutely.
So people think, because we see it on a screen, that he just goes to a place and instantly he sees creatures, but it doesn't work like that. You have to hang around, you have to travel from place to place, and if you want to see things, that's I imagine the point you were making. And also, I'm not having a go at David that much.
So, and then, like, you know, for example, I've been went to Indonesia and had some amazing. I'm very lucky that through some of the work that I've done with a charity, kind of doing training courses for kind of zoo keepers and sanctuary keepers around the world. Whenever back in my younger days before I had a child, I would always stay on longer and try and see some wildlife. So that hyena experience was one of the first, and still probably one of the best, just because of what it was and how it was. But, you know, we went to Sulawesi, and we went there to sort of see the wild macaques. And, you know, there's these massive troops of 80, you know, Sulawesi black-crested macaques walking around you, which, again, from someone who works in a zoo setting and knows how dangerous those animals are, that's actually really scary from the perspective of a little bit of knowledge and how big their canine teeth are and, you know, what 80 animals could do to you. That's terrifying, actually. But the guide said to us, are you interested in seeing tarsiers, which are these little kind of nocturnal primates, you know, incredibly hard to see. He's like, I know where their tree is. It's getting to the right time of night. Do you want to come and see them? And we were like, of course, yes, absolutely. That's like amazing. So he takes us to this tree, and we're certainly in my head, I'm under this illusion that we're going to sit and we're going to patiently wait until, you know, the light drops enough and the tarsiers kind of come out and start hunting. No, that's not how this particular tourist engagement works. He reaches into his bag, he pulls out an empty Coke bottle, which has a couple of locusts in it. So he then proceeds to take a locust out of the Coke bottle, wave it underneath the kind of the nesting area for these tarsiers, at which point they kind of stick their head out, because clearly they do this a lot. And then they kind of bounce down the tree, and he kind of holds the locust and tucks it away, and everyone takes their photographs, and a lot of people are using their flashes, which is incredibly bad for these, you know, night monkeys' eyes. And then he's like, right, have you all got your cameras ready? And he takes the locust and he puts it on the tree opposite. And he's right, I'm going to let it go in like 3 seconds, and he does a countdown, and he lets it go, and the tarsier leaps across this big gap and grabs the locust and then leaps back. did you all get your photos? Oh, no, you missed it. That's fine. I've got another locus. We'll do it again. And I'm like, me and my wife are just looking at each other going, this isn't, I wouldn't do this in a zoo.
Yeah.
This is so fake and it's so invasive. But it's, that's what, like the people who were with us, the, you know, the were like, this is incredible. This is the best wild animal experience ever. And it's like, this is not a wild animal. This is an animal that happens to live in the wild that's been trained to basically target to food and pose and jump and then go back to bed again. That's not a wild animal experience. I'd never knowingly pay for that kind of experience, you know. But it's, yeah. But there's, when the more you talk to people who actually do the real wild, there's more and more of this stuff. And it's supposed to be regulated and it's supposed to be controlled. But in a lot of cases, you know, unless the companies that you're going with have got really good ethics and stuff, like there's always exceptions, you know, to the people who are doing it the right way. And so, I mean, again, that's kind of one of the reasons why I actually feel there's a really important role to good zoos, good sanctuaries, because we can give people those amazing behavior experiences in a way that benefits the animal, in a way that is good for the animal and it's good for the people, without, you know, thousands of air miles and, you know, traipsing through forests that are diminishing, you know, all of the impactful things, you know, building lodges in places where, you know, they're supposed to be protecting habitats and things and bringing in emissions. And there's so much ethics. It literally blows my mind. And sometimes I just have to be like, no, I can't actually think about this anymore.
But it's,
again, I think there is nothing better than seeing a truly wild animal in the wild. But a lot of the time what people say they want isn't that, because it's hours and hours of waiting for nothing to happen and then trying all again the next day, which is actually, again, one of the reasons I really like the newer David Attenborough programs, where they actually show, you know, the guy freezing, you know, in the hide with his camera going, I've been here for 3 weeks and I haven't seen a single thing.
They're brilliant. I enjoy them as well. Watching, it's almost as good as the actual shows, that end bit where they're explaining the difficulties of getting the shot. As you say, it's also really important because it does make you realize if you are getting an easy sight, then something is probably wrong. And we won't go into it now because we're running out of time, but as you said, there's the difficulty of understanding which places to go in terms of animals in captivity, but it's not much easier to understand where to go to search for animals in the wild too. If you want to truly see animals in the wild, you should probably learn what you're doing and do it in a way which is sustainable for the animals and also safe for you, or work out who's doing it well ethically and who's doing it, as you say, really badly, and actually are doing something which, you know, you get in theme parks and you used to get in theme parks in the States, like that kind of idea of what you're doing with animals, rather than looking after them and just going out and seeing them. It's also difficult, but it's also amazing to have these stories and to be able to talk about all of this stuff and to have some of the experiences that you've had. I would love to find out more and more about them. I think you're going to have so many, and we didn't get into the billions of stories that that I'm sure you have of the individual animals either. We'll have to do that again. We'll just have a storytelling, animal storytelling with Mark. We'll do that episode at one point. But on that note, it's been enlightening. I think that's the word I will use for this. It's been fascinating. It's been shocking at times. But most of all, as it always is when we talk, Mark, and now our listeners are lucky enough to hear some of it too, it's been an absolute pleasure. If people want to find out more about you, if people would like to use your company for a team build or for to help you with Patreon, etc., where can you be found?
I think the easiest place is probably just on LinkedIn, basically. So, yeah, just Mark Kingston Jones on LinkedIn. If you want lots of animal-themed stuff in your newsfeed, fairly regularly, then yeah.
Trust me, you do.
Give me a connection. if you want hours of distracting videos, then yes, I'm the person for you, basically. But yeah, no, that's the best place to sort of get a good overview of what we do.
Amazing. We'll add that to the show notes, and obviously send me any extra links as well. We'll put them in the show notes so that people can find you. But as I said, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark. We will, as always, finish with a story from Puck Creations.
Wake up. Wake up, my little kinkajou. It's dark outside. You can see the night through. A forest has saved its sweet nectar for you. Wake up, wake up, my little kinkajou. They say that your hissing and high-pitched squeaks ward off harpy eagles as you rotate your hind feet. Your quick movement and long tail make you ready to flee. Your eyes as wide as the moon help you to see. Wake up, wake up, my little kinkajou. You've almost reached 40. Your moments are few. Unwrap your tail, see the world anew. Wake up, wake up, my little kinkajou.
You've just been listening to the Storytelling with Puck podcast. We'll be back very soon, so make sure you subscribe and catch up on any of the episodes you've missed.